Baruch says, thou hast forsaken the fountain of wisdom and wandered away from the way of God. So you forsake the fountain, you wander away on the false road. The same combination you get here. What we in the priesthood manual, this is a good one too, called one of the most powerful verses in the Book of Mormon, says the Jews despised the words of plainness and killed the prophets and sought for things they could not understand. Wherefore, because of their blindness, which blindness came by looking beyond the mark, they must needs fail. Now, this figure of looking beyond the mark comes out with surprising frequency now. Different sort, they usually move the mark or go beyond the bounds or cross the mark. In the that was in Jacob 4:14. But in the Zadokite fragment 1:16, the false teachers of Israel, he's talking about the false teachers, the very Jews of whom Jacob is speaking, are charged with the false teachers. He says, you have removed the mark which our forefathers had set up in their inheritance. Nay, all those who entered the covenant have broken out of the boundary of the law of God. They have stepped over the line and gone beyond the mark. This was the sin of the false teachers of the Jews. Remember, Jacob is talking about the wise ones. He's been talking about the Sherem, this type, the intellectuals, the Jews that wanted to be so smart. And for that reason, they overlooked the simple things and went beyond the mark. That's exactly the charge that the Zadokite fragment is bringing, and he's bringing it against the false teachers who had been teaching the Jews at this time, the very same smart alecks, in the very same sort of way. Interesting thing he uses that. The reason the people receive error, according to the so-called gospel of truth, is that they insist on looking for a God who is so far beyond the mark. Here you are again, you see. And this is the early Christian writing, the early Christian library from Egypt, using the same expression. They insist on looking for a God who is far beyond the mark, far beyond any place that you'll be able to measure. So when they expect that kind of God, they're not going to find him. Now the tree of life is very common. Here we won't go into that, but the idea of its being white is not common. Here's an odd twist. For example, the perfect whiteness of the tree. 1 Nephi 11 and 8 says, calls it the whitest of trees, and the fruit thereof is exceeding white. Nephi 8 and 10. Whiteness is not an appetizing quality in fruit or trees or fruit. I wouldn't like to eat perfectly white fruit. And we don't think perfectly white trees are particularly charming unless they're covered with blossoms and so forth. But this is totally white, the whitest of trees. And yet, we get this again, this whiteness of the trees and the fruit. In the creation apocryphon, the tree of life, it says, looked like a cypress, that it had fruit that was perfectly white. Incidentally, in the newly discovered Genesis apocryphon, Abraham compares himself in a dream to the cedar tree. Nephi makes much of those lost souls who refuse to eat the fruit of the tree, and this reminds us of the newly discovered Logion of Jesus. You do not know who I am. You who have become as the Jews who love the tree but hate its fruit. Then, the story of the olive tree here. It's the prophet Zenos who lived long ago in Palestine. Here, we're going to skip down here. This is a particularly valuable clue. More common than the image of the water or the tree are those pictures in which they appear together, the tree growing by the water of life. Again, a natural combination. So we'll turn to a specialized instance, the story of the olive tree. This is a particularly valuable clue, since the author, Jacob, gives his source. It is the prophet Zenos, who lived long ago in Palestine. He's not a New World prophet. He's not a Nephite or anything like that. He goes way back. He is introduced in the Book of Mormon a number of times as representative of a long line of messianic prophets who suffered persecution for his messianic teachings. It's a good place to consider his case. He was no minor prophet. He's cited more than any other prophet but Isaiah in the Book of Mormon. His name, along with other prophets, Zenoch, Enos, Isaiah, Nahum, who have disappeared without a trace. The Book of Mormon explains why they disappeared. Their messianic doctrine was highly offensive to the leaders of the Jews. But is the existence of such a line plausible? It's not only plausible today, it's demonstrable. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, forgotten prophets of major stature now emerge. Speaking of one of these, Father Danielu writes, we quoted some of this last night, between the great prophets of the Old Testament and John the Baptist, there emerges as a new link, this new line of prophets. One of the great figures of Israel's prophetic tradition. It is amazing, he says, that he has remained so unknown for so long. Now that he is known, the question arises, what are we to do about this knowledge? It's a question that is posed to the Jews. Furthermore, the question is put to the Christians. Why does not this message then form part of the inspired scriptures? The Book of Mormon gives the answer clearly. Take the case of Zenos. We are actually given a brief biography of him, and a very precious one, in Alma 33. And here you get his life history. Do you remember to have read, notice that his written works are in the possession of the Nephites. They brought them with them across the water. So he reminds them, this is 550 years after the people came over, 525 years. And he says, don't you remember to have read? So he was popular. People are expected to have read this Zenos. Lots of people knew about him. Don't you remember to have read what Zenos, the prophet of old, this old Zenos, said concerning prayer or worship? He said, quote, they actually had the books at hand, and he was able to quote them. Thou art merciful, O God, starts right out like a thanksgiving hymn from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we're going to see that this man who writes these hymns talks just like it. This may be Zenos, incidentally, who writes this hymn. My guess is probably he is, because he writes the same hymns in the same way. And he tells us about the olive trees, too. Do you remember to have read what Zenos, the prophet of old, was said? Now, in 1893, they did discover some fragments of an old Hebrew messianic prophet, Zenos. And Zenes, sometimes he's called Zenos sometimes, but Zenos is his name. And they're just a few fragments. They're published in Cambridge, 93, edited by Montague Rhodes himself at that time. We'll have to get some photographs of them. But there was such a prophet, in other words. For he said, thou art merciful, O God, for thou hast heard my prayer, even when I was in the wilderness. Ah, he was in the desert. He was one of these wilderness prophets. First clue. Yea, thou wast merciful when I prayed concerning those who were my enemies. Aha, he had enemies. They were making trouble for him. And thou didst turn them to me. Ah, but they turned to him again. He won them back again. This is the troubles you usually find out here. Then what happened? Yea, O God, thou wast merciful unto me when I did cry unto thee in my field. Ah, he worked in the field. When I did cry unto thee in my prayer, thou didst hear me. And again, O God, when I did return to my house, thou didst hear me in my prayer. Then he says, O God, thou hast been merciful unto me and heard my cries in the midst of thy congregations. Congregations only occurs once in the Old Testament, and that's from the Psalms, in the Psalms. The midst of the congregations occurs repeatedly in the Dead Sea Scrolls. These are the communities out in the desert. When I did cry unto thee in my prayer, thou didst hear me. And again, O God, when I did return to my house, thou didst hear me in my prayer. Then he says, O God, thou hast been merciful unto me and heard my cries in the midst of thy congregations. Congregations only occurs once in the Old Testament, and that's from the Psalms, in the Psalms. The midst of the congregations occurs repeatedly in the Dead Sea Scrolls. These are the communities out in the desert. Etzah. Remember, they had so many words we saw last night for congregation. They use so, they use Etzah, they use Yecheth, they use Ma'adha, they all sorts of words for congregation. But here he is moving in the wilderness, being rejected. People take him back again. He prays as he goes, and then he's accepted. His voice is heard in the midst of the congregations, in the plural. He's taken in by some of these communities out there. But notice the rough time he has. In the midst of thy congregations, this occurs, you see, out there. Yea, and thou hast also heard me when I have been cast out, and have been despised by my enemies. The tables turned against him again. Thou didst hear my cries and wast angry with mine enemies. The tables are turned against them. And thou didst visit them in thine anger with speedy destruction. Some big overthrow, something calamitous happened to them. And thou didst hear me because of my afflictions and my sincerity, and it is because of thy Son that thou hast thus been merciful unto me. Therefore I will cry unto thee, for in me is thy joy. Thou hast turned thy judgments from me because of thy Son. And now, says Alma, unto them, do you believe those scriptures which have been written by them of old? So he's reading them the scriptures, and it's the writings of this Zenos. And then he goes on and tells about Zenok and how he was put to death. But here we have a biographical sketch, which is a very interesting one. There's more about Zenos in other parts of the Book of Mormon. Notice from verse 3 that even the Zoramites know about Zenos. He's preaching to the Zoramites here. According to Alma, they actually had read his words, from which it's clear that his writings are among those contained in records brought from Jerusalem by Lehi and his family. This being so, it becomes clearer yet how intimate Lehi's people were with that outcast desert branch of Judaism, of which this man is so representative, which they constantly refer and which they constantly associate themselves. Now let's turn to the writer of the wonderful Thanksgiving hymns of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Hymn H and Hymn O. Hymn H is his own biography, and Hymn O is one of those in which he talks about the trees. He talks about olives quite a good deal, but it's scattered around. There's a good tree passage in Hymn H, so we'll refer in Hymn O. But first to Hymn H. It starts out, I thank thee, O my Lord, exactly as Alma does, quoting Zenos. And he says, Those who have led thy people astray, those false prophets, who by their flattering words, notice the false prophets in the Book of Mormon, the Sherems and the Nehors and the Zizrams and people like that and the Korihors, always flattering words. In other words, and here's the same thing. This prophet is dealing. They'd always had these false prophets to run up with. Lehi knows all about them. Jerusalem is swarming with them in his time. And we've recently discovered in the writing of Baluchah a false prophet who made a lot of trouble for Isaiah, who gained the ear of the king and was responsible for having Isaiah thrown out. But these false prophets are an institution in Israel, and these people are in the desert mostly because of their machinations that have caused them to be driven out. So there's lots of tension between the two, and this is part of the tradition that's carried across the water by these people, because remember, it tells us specifically that Laman and Lemuel favored that other faction in Israel. They liked to go along with those people, and they accused Lehi and Nephi of being of the visionary type of prophet that they didn't like. They like the other school of prophets. So this old feud is carried right over into the new world, and this type of prophecy carries right on. So he says, those false prophets who have seduced thy people by their flattering words and have by their tricks and their falsehood wrested the scripture. And I was despised by them, he said. They held me in no esteem whatever. They caused me to be cast out. Here's our friend Zenos. They drove me out of the country and out of their communities like a bird from his nest. Again, he was driven out. Remember, he had to wander. All my companions, all those who were my followers and friends, were turned against me. And then Lehi, remember, he says, they turned against me right at the beginning. Zeno says, and then they turned back to him again. The same thing happens here. Were turned against me. They considered me as of no more any use. While they, those false interpreters, those liars, they formed against me a clever plan, plots of Belial. And by twisting the law, which thou hast engraved in my heart, they, by their flattering words, led my people, thy people, astray. And they have forbidden those who were thirsty from going and drinking of the water of life and of knowledge. Notice this Book of Mormon imagery always coming back in again, this early period in the Book of Mormon, when these memories are so vivid. They've forbidden them to partake of the waters of life. They have blocked them up from it. They have kept the thirsty from drinking therefrom, even when they had thirst. They made them drink vinegar. Here it's not filthy water, but it's vinegar. And we have seen their distress. They have been caught in their nets, tricked and led astray. Oh, and they, those who are hypocrites, those whose projects were those of Belial, those who conceived evil and sought for my undoing, being double-hearted, those who were not true in the way, who were not firm in the way of truth, their root has produced a bitter fruit. Here there you get the bitter fruit of the olives that he liked to talk about too, the bitter olive. And their obstinate hearts are now seeking after idols, because thou hast caused them to stumble in their... Here's your stumbling block of Nephi. See? Thou hast caused them to stumble in their sins, and they have fallen on their face. They have not been able to oppose me. They have not been able to achieve their ends. For they did not hearken to thy voice. They did not lend their ear to thy word. For they have said of the vision and revelation, there is no more vision, there is no more revelation. And this way they led this people astray from the way of thy heart. And then that they may be taken in their own thoughts and lead many away from thy covenants. But thou, O Lord, will affirm thy judgments and will reveal the trickery, the wickedness of all men, and they will not find themselves successful. Thou shalt turn their own influence again. Then he goes on and talks about them, how they will be overthrown. As for me, because I have leaned on thee, I will arise, I will be victorious again, he says. I will arise again and will return to those people, will preach to them again. I will go again to those who despised me, who turned their hand against me because they had been led astray by false teachers, false traditions. Again, your Book of Mormon missionary stories. And had me as a thing of naught. And then here. For thou didst appear to me in a vision just at dawn, and my face was not covered with shame. And all those who have sought after me have now come back again and joined into thy alliance and are now listening to my word. And those are now walking in a way which is dear to thy heart. They have ranged themselves on my side. They have again adjoined the assembly of the saints. Thou hast made triumph their cause through justice. Thou hast made, yes, their cause through truth and through justice. And thou hast given no concern for those miserable ones who have gone astray. Well, this is the way this man writes. See, it's the same story of Zenos, who's driven out like a bird from his nest, who comes back, his winds, notice the sudden overthrow of the enemies, and he turns back victorious. But then the way he talks about the trees and so forth, he says, he describes Israel as God's plantation in which he plants trees in various parts of the world, and the fruit shouldn't be bitter and so forth. Thou hast planted a plant, thou hast planted precious trees, he says, and then he says cypresses and elms, mixed with all sorts for thy glory. These are trees of life. Throughout secret places, in unknown places, again, remember they're planted in secret places in Zenos' story, in Jacob. Remember, Jacob is just quoting Zenos, that's all. And he says, these are planted for an eternal planting, and they shall take root in the various places where they've been set up, in many places, and they shall send out their roots toward the waters, even toward the waters of life. And those that don't send out their roots won't have the waters of life, and then they'll bear good fruit. And from these trees, which partake of the water, they shall raise up their branches, because of their planting they shall grow and they shall flourish. And thou, O God, thou hast shut in thy vineyard. Notice he's calling the orchards vineyards here. In the mystery of those who are valiant in thy service, who come to work in the vineyard, and the sacred spirits, the spirits of the saints, rather, that work for thee. And with ancient trees, they do not, with ancient and withered trees, they do not drink the water, even the water of holiness. Therefore they wither up and are lost. See, he's using this same imagery as the withered trees that don't partake of the water, the trees being cultivated, that God has his trees and so forth. Some will bear good fruit, others will not. The trees get old and die and are weak. The same sort of thing. This, remember, would be written many hundreds of years after Zenos and would come down in this form to these people. These hymns, very valuable because they're beautiful hymns. Whereas Alma would probably have a better text, I don't know. But they're certainly the same type of man doing the same type of thing, writing the same type of scripture. We should note here, aside from literary parallels, that Jacob's treatment of olive culture in the Book of Mormon shows a remarkable grasp of the business. Remember what he says about them? It's a long, long section. It's the one that always stops the little kids. They start reading the Book of Mormon, and everything goes lovely until they get to Jacob and the olive tree, and then they grind to a halt, like walking through the sand. That's as far as I ever got for years. I'd start out with high resolve, and as soon as I got to the olive part, but as Brother Joseph Fielding says, it's the best part of the Book of Mormon, really. It's the most powerful part, but there's a lot to it. But how much he knows about olive culture. They know all about it. We looked this up in a book, so we know now, see? Olive trees do have to be pruned and cultivated diligently. They were commonly planted in vineyard areas in the Old World. In fact, the word Carmel means either olive orchard or vineyard. And you notice the words are used interchangeably in Jacob's account. The tops do perish first. The good stock is greatly cherished. And if you get a good olive tree, it's rarer than fine gold because they do everything they can to preserve it, some having been preserved for as long as 3,500 years, trees still alive today. The stock is so rare, so important. Then the common way... That's the French who just made a study of that, Lota. The common way of strengthening the old trees was indeed, and it still is in Greece, to graft in the shoots of the wild olive, the oleaster, when the tree started to get weak. Olive shoots from valuable old trees were often transplanted to keep the stock alive, as the Lord does in here. The best trees do grow, surprisingly, on the poorest and rockiest grounds, whereas very rich soil produces inferior fruit. Nevertheless, it must be very diligently fertilized and dug and dunged, especially. And since ancient times, this has been practiced in olive orchards. These fertilizing, again, it uses the very expression in the Book of Mormon. The grafting of shoots does lead to a cluttered variety of fruit and is considered a risky business. And it does. Remember, our tree is cumbered with all sorts of fruit because we did too much grafting, he says. The top branches, if allowed to grow, as they are in Spain and France, to provide shade trees along roads, make a picturesque trees, but completely sap the strength of the trees, as they do in the Book of Mormon. The tall branch, remember, the branches took away the strength of the tree that got too high. The thing most to be guarded against in the fruit, of course, is bitterness. And so all these things are out, casually you'll find them in the story in Jacob of the olive culture. This is just the lesson in agriculture. But who would know anything about olive culture in upstate New York in 1829? I mean, who does today? I mean, it's all quite accurate. And it's the ancient method. This is the thing. Also, it's not the way it's done today necessarily, but of course olive culture is very ancient. But all this is very authentic old stuff. Well, here's the fountain of life. Let's see if we can get a good one here. I see we're all getting tired. You see, I haven't even halfway through here. But I want to find some rather interesting ones here. Well, that's a pretty good one. Fruit of the tree of life. Here's this messianic line. We talked about them and the false prophets. Here's an interesting one, the false prophets. The tradition of false prophets, like Sherem, Nehor, or Zizrom, and so forth, now gets brilliant illumination from the Dead Sea Scrolls, where the society constantly has to contend with these false prophets. We gave examples here. They're the false teachers, the intellectuals who drench the people with dirty water and give a bad time to the true leaders. Most conspicuous among them is the man of the lie in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the book of, and this goes back to a very early time. This goes back at least to the time of Jeremiah. Here is this account of Belekah here from the ascension of Isaiah. Belekah was a false prophet. He was found, says this writing, in the days of Hezekiah, speaking words of lawlessness in Jerusalem. He accused Isaiah, the prophet, and those who were with him, saying, Isaiah himself has said. Now notice how clever he is in his arguments, just exactly as the prophets argue in the Book of Mormon. Isaiah himself has said, I see more than Moses the prophet. He said that because Moses said, no man can see God and live. And Isaiah has said, I have seen God and behold, I live. And he has said that Jerusalem, this great city, should be destroyed. How can this Jerusalem, this great city, be destroyed? Well, here's your typical Book of Mormon false prophet going around using clever arguments and contradictions to tie people up. And the flattering words. And Belekah led most of the people away and definitely got the edge over Isaiah. There's Zadokai. And the idea of quarantine, that's... The idea of the lone prophet is an instrument here. The way they observe the law of Moses is unique. The Sarah scrolls and those who wait for him. This is a very important one. This flight into the desert, remember, only begins with Lehi in the Book of Mormon. They keep flying forever after the righteous in the Book of Mormon. It's continued all through the Book of Mormon. You don't need to go into that. In this, they consciously compare themselves with the movement of Israel in the desert. They make a conscious thing of it. Nephi fled into the wilderness from his brethren, he says, so he could observe to keep the judgments, statutes, and commandments of the Lord in all things according to the law of Moses. Practically the opening first two lines of the Dead Sea Scroll. That they may keep all his judgments, his commandments, and his laws according as been given by the holy by Moses and by all the holy prophets. And here, so that he could keep... Notice that redundance of expression which is so characteristic. What's the difference between a statute and a commandment and a judgment? And the law. They're all the same, but this is a necessary... this would be very tasteless in our way of writing things. You notice they always do it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They never just say one thing. They always use the three, as if there were some charm connected with it. But this is the way it is. This is exactly the object of Qumran. They went out for the same purpose and in the same way. Keeping the law thus, says Jacob, it is sanctified to us for righteousness, even as it was according to Abraham in the wilderness. See, they're now comparing themselves with Abraham in the wilderness. Wherefore we search the prophets, he says, that we have many revelations and the spirit of prophecy. They were an inspired, charismatic group out there, searching the prophets and having their own revelations. It was with us, says Jacob, even as it was in the provocation of the days of temptation while the children of Israel were in the wilderness. Now they're comparing themselves with the children of Israel in the time of Moses being in the wilderness. 1 Nephi 17 compares every phase of Israel's wandering in the wilderness to that of his own people, including their rebellion. And notwithstanding they being led, the Lord their God, their Redeemer going before them, they hardened their hearts and reviled against Moses, says Nephi, comparing his own people to that. The reference to the Redeemer here is very significant. The Lord their God, their Redeemer, going before them, the Goel, because the study is now being made about the wilderness, the patriarchal tradition and Moses is the great emphasis on the Goel, the doctrine of the Redeemer, which is a new thing in Old Testament study. Because here it is, you see, it was the Redeemer who was leading them, the way Nephi puts it. The general principle is clearly stated by Nephi, "For I did liken all scriptures unto us, that it might be for our profit and learning." It all applies to us. Now, this is exactly the attitude of the desert sectaries, who insist on comparing themselves with early Israel at every turn, and this is what has, at first, made the confusion in the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls so great, because people couldn't, with what are they comparing themselves with any period in Israel? Who are they talking about? Well, anything, doesn't make any difference. They compare all scriptures to themselves for their profit and learning. Who, for example, in the Habakkuk commentary, they take Habakkuk and compare the things described in Habakkuk with other battles that Israel has had to fight. Who were the Kittim, for example? Are they the Romans? Are they the Greeks? Are they the Babylonians? Are they the Assyrians? Are they the Persians? Are they the Philistines? Various scholars say it was one and say it the other, had a big fight, and suddenly it occurred to them, well, it was all of them. Could be anyone. They're comparing all of the scriptures to themselves, to their own fight. Israel had done it before. So today they're no longer thrashing that out as they used to. I remember my friend Isaac Rabinowitz started it going. And we were at school together. We took from Popper, Professor Popper. He was our old Hebrew teacher together. And he was the one that first suggested that the Kittim were the Romans and then various other things. And there was, in the 1950s, a very active discussion. All that's been put to bed now because this principle of Lehi's did liken all the scriptures to ourselves for our instruction, our profit and learning. When the Zadokite fragment deplores the apostasy of Israel in its own time, it reminds us this is the very thing that Jeremiah said to Baruch, as our friend Baruch, and which Elisha, see, long before, said to his servant Gehazi. All of them have forsaken the well of living water. See the same combinations of ideas. All of them have forsaken. They're talking about the Zadokite fragment up at Damascus now. They have forsaken it, just as Jeremiah said to Baruch, time of Lehi, just as Elisha said to his servant Gehazi long before that. They're comparing it to themselves. The Rechabites, already in the time of Lehi, were observing this principle. They call themselves the ones who have kept the covenants of their fathers. Now, what's this? We keep going on and on, seems again. Well, here's another peculiar thing, too. I'm not going to keep you. The peculiarity of the Apocrypha is their description of the righteous as the poor. The Milhamah scroll, this is very striking. Remember, it's a battle scroll. They arrange themselves for battle and go forth in their might. And it's a very elaborate arrangement of things, skillfully ordered, but with strict ritual accompaniments. And this, incidentally, is another characteristic thing of the Book of Mormon, is the ritual nature of war, which is very strongly marked. I'll mention that later. Well, anyway, it says, after all this has been done, we don't have a chance. If we win at all, it says it will be the same way David beat Goliath, because the Lord helped him. We are the poor. And then it says, the hosts of Israel are always described as being the poor, the downtrodden, those cast out from the world, as against the world, which are the mighty and the powerful and so forth. The issue is always drawn between the rich and the poor. However correct this may be, it's strictly in the tradition of the Book of Mormon, where the poor are referred to no less than 30 times as God's people are called the poor. So that H.J. Shep says the proper designation for these people in the Dead Sea should be Ebionim, the poor. They always just talked about themselves as the poor, as against the rest of the world, as against the rest of Israel. And this emphasis on the poor, the outcast as being the poor, giving themselves that name, is very conspicuous in the Book of Mormon, I say more than 30 times, and also in all these new writings. They're the poor. Well, the organization of the church, that's rather an elaborate thing that we've got here. Hey, that was just upside down. Now, this keeping of the books and the reading of the records is a striking thing, too. You notice they're always reading out of it. Nephi says here, I will read from Isaiah, who speaks concerning the house of Israel. Wherefore, they may be likened to you, who are of the house of Israel. Then there is a remarkable thing. He says, I've read these things, that ye might know concerning the covenants that he has spoken to the Jews from generation to generation. Notice this, that ye might know the concerning the covenants he's spoken to the Jews. I read you these things that ye might know concerning the covenants he has spoken to the Jews from generation to generation until the time comes that they shall be restored to the true church and fold of God. The manual of discipline begins by instructing that these things shall be read to them from generation to generation until the restoration of Israel. The very same thing. Alma had to get permission from King Mosiah to found churches. Wherefore, it says, they did assemble themselves together in different bodies, being called churches, with priests and teachers at their head. And they were called the people of God, which is exactly what the Jewish sectaries called themselves, the B'nai El. Limhi wanted to found a community on these lines, but he couldn't because he lacked the authority. Therefore, they did not at that time form themselves into a church, waiting upon the Spirit of the Lord. The tradition goes right back to Jerusalem, where Zoram, remember, thought that Nephi spake of the brethren of the church. But this waiting upon the Spirit of the Lord, very common again. The word ad is used a great deal. Remember, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, everything is only until there shall come a Messiah of Aaron and Israel. It's only temporary. They're simply waiting upon the Lord. They describe themselves as the remnant and those who are waiting as the church of anticipation. Here's talking about the battle. In Alma 44 and 5, we have what can only be called a rule of battle for the sons of light. It's an interesting thing. Of course, there's lots of reference to this in the Book of Mormon. War is a highly ritualized in the Book of Mormon. This is one thing that used to excite derision of Book of Mormon critics. What could be sillier, they used to ask, than a general who would give away his plan of battle to the enemy or allow him to choose the time and the terrain? And yet this very particular and strictly in order. Here is Pa'anki, here's a new study by Gardner himself called, it's called Pa'anki's Instructions to His Army. Notice the name, that peculiar name. Pa'anki was a general just before the time of Lehi, was very famous, became king of Egypt, and many men, the name became quite popular afterwards. Pa'anki, it means Ammon is my life. But of course the name first occurs in Book of Mormon where the three judges have their fight and one of them is called Pa'anki. It's a good, pure Jewish name, Egyptian name, and one odd enough that no one could have possibly have invented it. It was this, I think, this name, I strongly suspect, that first put Professor Albright on the track of the Book of Mormon. He recognizing that it couldn't possibly have been faked or forged or anything else. Well, what could be sillier then? Well, here's Pa'anki, and this is the instructions. Pa'anki commands his general, this is quoting from Gardner, to give the enemy the choice of the time and the place for the fight. This was the way it was regularly done. You arrange your battles ahead of time, just as the Book of Mormon people used to. We'll end on a rather striking note. We've already written somewhat about patternism and the royal cult in the Book of Mormon and the Near East. Some points have recently arisen which deserve notice since then. G. Forer, in 1959... published a study called The Contract Between the King and the People in Israel. This is exactly what we have in Mosiah, of course, is a formal contract entered by the king and the people. Racine has pointed out that according to the Talmud, when Josiah convoked all the priests and prophets and the people of Jerusalem and read its contents to them from a platform erected in the court of the temple, this reading the law to the people from a platform, you see. This is the way Benjamin does. The people enthusiastically entered into a new covenant, quote, to walk after the Lord and keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes. Notice the three, the commandments, testimonies, and statutes. The king reads it to them, they enter into the contract, the covenant, exactly as you find it in the Book of Mosiah, in the Book of Mormon. And the tower is interesting here. We have the best description of that in Nathan the Babylonian, a 10th century writer, who witnessed it with his own eyes in the 9th century coronation of the exilarch, the Hebrew king in exile. It's not described in the Bible, but it's fully set forth there, and it's very much as it's described in the Book of Mormon. But the most striking thing is Benjamin's oration. A very Book of Mormon character was King Horemheb of Egypt, a philanthropic, idealistic, religious man who had a dream and founded a dynasty. But in Israel, these were not merely individual but formalized qualities. J.K. Bernhardt has recently shown that the sacral kingship in Israel, the priesthood of Aaron transferred to Melchizedek, transferred to Aaron, goes back indeed to the common great year festival, he says, as we said it does. But, he says, with a difference. In Israel, it got a peculiar twist. There is, he notes, a marked tendency to democratization which receives its most striking expression in an oration which the king is expected to give on the occasion of his coronation. He says, and we're quoting, the characteristic feature of the Israelitic concept of kingship is the formal refusal of the office of king with explanatory arguments. The custom of a royal polemic on the subject of kingship is among the oldest utterances about monarchy in the Old Testament. He's searching these things out now. The king formally refuses the office and accepts it on another grounds. Benjamin, remember, formally refuses in a set oration to accept the kingly office in its standard Near Eastern form. He says, you do this, but you do it to Father. You don't do it to me. I've never asked you to bring the treasures as you do to the king, your offerings. I've never asked you for offerings. I've never put taxes upon you and so forth. I don't ask you to bow down to me. You acclaim me. I've been elected and this, that, and the other. But he gives the whole thing a human and a much broader twist and a democratic turn. At the end of his speech, he has the people formally enter a covenant with the statement, this day you have become the children of God. This day he hath begotten you. In the newly found sayings of Moses from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're taken back to the occasion on which the state of Israel was founded. The kingdom was founded with Moses. And Moses announces it with a formal statement, this day you have become the people of God. Then follows a list of all the good things that God has given them, the vineyards and the olive trees which you did not plant, and you can eat and be filled, for God had given them victory over their enemies. Well, need we discuss Benjamin's oration with victory and plenty as the theme and sharing with your neighbor and so forth, his formal renunciation of kingship, or as Bernhardt puts it, the characteristic feature is the formal refusal of the office of king with explanatory arguments. Now, Benjamin does. He refuses it in the old sense and gives his explanatory arguments, his speech on government. This is a royal polemic on the subject of kingship. Well, he gives them a royal polemic on the subject of kingship. And this is among the oldest practices of the Israelite nation. It's not a recent thing. It always went with kingship. But most of the royal rites are lost. They're not in the Bible. They're not prophetic writings, except in the Psalms. That has to do a lot with the coronation. Some of the Psalms do. So this stuff is now meeting us just exactly as it is down there in the Book of Mormon. But even in Egypt, something happens like this. Here's a description of an Egyptian coronation, typical one as Moray has revived it. The king introduces his son and announces his name, Benjamin, Mosiah, see? Declaring him to be his successor on the throne. All present then acclaim him in a single voice at the invitation of the king, who then gives an oration. This speech of the king, and we're quoting now from Moray, this speech of the king is received with an acclamation, which proclaims the name of the new king. Then all smell the earth at his feet. They fall down in prostration, you see, prostrating themselves at the royal command. Notice Benjamin accepts the prostration, only on condition that it is for your heavenly king. He says, I know you've fallen down. That's the thing you should do. We always do on this occasion. But remember, you're falling down for God and not for me. Your heavenly king, he says. For the absent ones, a copy of circular, and this is in Egypt too. For the absent ones, a copy of a circular, as Moray puts it, is sent around the land, telling of the coronation. This was all strictly understood by the Egyptians to correspond to the assembly in heaven. After the acclamation, the king receives a crown from God, is purified, clothed in a holy garment, and takes his place in the double divine pavilion with a man on either side of him, priest on either side of him representing Seth and Horus. They're wearing masks usually. And there he's thrown, crowned on his throne, but always with the three. And this is exactly the way the Jews do it in the Nathan the Babylonian writing. Well, and then the dancing maiden. So I think we'll end with the royal coronation, because that ends with a thunderous acclamation, you see, and that's the place we should leave it. If we've got properly mixed up. Well, we have a few minutes if we want to drag it out. If anyone wants to ask any questions, if you want, you can spare yourself the agony. I see nobody asking here. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do very hard, you see, is to keep the gate shut here. They like the idea that what we are doing is expanding our knowledge of the Bible, but we don't want to admit anything into the corpus. But as this Daniello said, we quoted tonight and last night also, The question now arises, and he is the best Catholic man on the subject without any doubt. He says, the big question arising now both for Jews and for Christians is, what are we going to do with this? We can't leave it out of the Scripture. It shouldn't be Scripture. Well, he wasn't writing this article in Life. Remember, Life are very careful whom they choose to write these things. No, that just represents one opinion. This is an opinion, probably conservative Protestant, that didn't want to open the door to... Because they said it'd be rather dangerous if we started doing this. People would be going out, getting these translations from themselves and started using them as scriptures. Through what official channels is this stuff going to pass? This is what they're so concerned about in Rome now. They want to keep this stuff under their control, so they're willing to make concessions now so that they'll be the ones who do the conceding. At least that's the least thing that can happen. Because otherwise, this will get out of hand. There's so much of this stuff coming out now. And if it's recognized as being holy, where are you? What's happened to your authority? So they're trying to guard it rather carefully, trying to keep control. That's why they're not being publicized as much as they deserve. See, these aren't the first great discoveries. Way back in 1875, when the Didache, that was just as sensational a thing as you can imagine. And they hush them up just like that. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1895, 1897, they were first known. This was a Zadokite fragment. It was one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, discovered in Cairo in a mosque which had formerly been the old Cairo synagogue. It had been walled up there for hundreds and hundreds of years in the wall and taken out. Sure enough, it belonged to the Damascus group that went up north from the Dead Sea, and it was the earliest writing there. And there it was, and it was suppressed. It was Schechter who discovered it, suppressed it for 14 years because it was such a jar. And look how savagely they have been fighting this on some people who have. Christians like Driver or Jews like Schechter and Seitlin, people like that, they don't like it. It overthrows their life's work, after all, is in jeopardy, or so they think, because it's going to put things in an awfully new... They won't be read anymore if this stuff is as valuable as it undoubtedly is. Nobody's going to read them anymore. And they don't like to look forward to that dismal future. Yes, Sister... Yes, that's very true. The Apocrypha were declared to the American Bible Society in 1816, absolutely outlawed, and they had great influence, absolutely outlawed the Apocrypha. They were regarded as devilish works, not to be used at all, so they had no prestige, were not read, were not known at all. They weren't published in this country. They were practically suppressed. Nothing was known about them. No, this is new. And the Apocrypha reached their lowest level in 1945, H.H. Rowley, the last surviving person to study Apocrypha, said, we'll just close the door now and forget about these. Nobody's reading these anymore, and it's so. And then, bingo, next year, the whole thing broke loose again, and everyone was embarrassed because there was no one who knew anything about Apocrypha. It caught them completely off guard. So, it's a very important thing, one study that should be made, exactly what books were available to Joseph Smith in his time. Wilfred Poulsen got a bibliography of works available in libraries in Palmyra in Joseph Smith's time. I think Dick Anderson was able to get, he was trying to get, I think he got a copy of that. There we could see what books at the most, if Joseph Smith had read them all, which would certainly be doubtful, since he was very busy, they were very hard pressed by poverty and so forth, what could he have had at his disposal? And it's very little, very little. Allowing the maximum, the largest possible... If he'd spent all his time doing nothing but study and had people go around the countryside bringing these books to him, he still wouldn't have had much to go on, very little to go on. We didn't use our blackboard much. I was expecting to put something else on, but it's just as well. Yes, we'll get around here. Everybody's sitting in a line here is the trouble. Excuse me. I should know your names. He reads it, which is more than most of us do. That's all I can tell you about it. Now, look, if he's read it more than once and he still reads it, what do you think he thinks about it? As a man whose time is as valuable as his, whose eyesight is as poor as his, he's had very serious eye operations. He has to spare his energy for a little time. But he told me that he'd read it a number of times. Yes, he does read it. So I don't know whether he's reading it right now or not. As I say, he has to guard his daylight very, very carefully now. Because he's read so much. Chauncey? Oh, excuse me, there was a brother down here.
The statement was made that
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And David Patton, I believe it is, makes a statement that he was riding along and this man met him and introduced himself as Cain, that he could not die. He wished he could.
That's interesting. Well, he's a wandering spirit, all right. He's still on the earth, but even that, we wouldn't have to be in the flesh. He wouldn't have to be in the flesh to be wandering on the earth. That's the devil himself. He could very well have died. What the point of this is, this story is, simply it's given as a legend, that the idea of the great house that falls is a very early Hebrew concept. It's not necessarily borrowed from medieval Arabic sources. It's very old, see, the idea of the great house full of finely dressed people, which is the vanity of the world and which falls down, which is their overthrow, that Cain met his great overthrow in the fall of his stone house. This is a very old story and goes back. Now, whether it really did or not has nothing to do with it, because in Book of Mormon, it's purely given as an image and a type. See, it's given as a metaphor. This is the vanity of the world. He tells us this is not an allegory, see, and it's not a real history, because Nephi is good enough to tell us, I saw that house and that was the vanity of the world. That represents something. Not a real house. That was the vanity of the world. See, it's very careful. They specify when they're using types and images and when they're using the real thing. The types and images are very important to convey certain ideas. But he's giving that merely as an example, as an old one. But as this business of Cain's being still alive, that's another story. I don't want to talk about that. I know some stories about that too. Some pretty good ones. Well, good. The next person to raise his hand can give the closing prayer. Chauncey?
I'd like to ask one question, if you don't mind. As I have listened to you these last two nights, and also in listening to you over a period of several years, I've been wondering what kind of an hypothesis about the ancient world will fit all this evidence that is coming forth. It seems to me that, contrary to the idea that we usually get of a gradual development of culture and language and that sort of thing, the only thing I can fit with all the evidences that I hear you bringing forth is the fact that in the ancient world, there must have been a tremendous wealth, and not only that, but a widely dispersed culture, theory of government, understanding of language, and so forth, that was very powerful. And it may have been, maybe they didn't have as high a technology as we have, but apparently their insights into the understanding of the basis of life was far superior than anything as you see today. As you look today in the writings of philosophers, for instance, you find a dearth of real understanding of the nature of the human dilemma. But the things that you mentioned, this is their concern. They're rich in that. Would you care to speak to that for a minute?
Yes. We mustn't underestimate their technical knowledge either. Technical knowledge is a thing that can get lost. You realize, if you've read that book called The Legacy of Greece, it was some years ago, they calculated the point of knowledge the Greeks had reached when they finally lost it all. We never guessed how high they'd gone, and it was reached that we came to in mathematics, even, about 1911. They'd got as far as we had got in 1911, the Greeks had, before they passed out. Now, that was all lost. See, when this stuff goes, it goes. And all that we have today can go that way, too. So lost technology is a very hard thing. One discovery will suddenly break things wide open. Now, the fact, for example, that the early Babylonians and Egyptians were quite familiar with the phases of Venus, with the moons of Jupiter, things like that. They must have had telescopes to see them with. But this other knowledge, this new book of Cyrus Gordon's is good on that. The technological one, this one of Paul Herman's called Discovery by Man, is very interesting on that. It shows how much has been lost that they really did know, that their achievements were tremendous. They used different solutions to the problem, very ingenious sometimes. We would think very simple. But they got their solutions. And they could do amazing things. With this other one, this book of Cyrus Gordon's called Before the Bible, he talks about the Jews and the Greeks sharing a common culture before the Bible in very early times. He talks about that. As you get back, you move toward a core of of astonishing sophistication and advancement. What we've been doing is coasting downhill ever since, apparently. This was the conclusion, certainly, that Lord Raglan reached for so many years, the president, founder of the Folklore Society in England, in his book called The Origins of Religion. I've had four copies stolen so far, if anybody... Now it's very hard to get. He concludes that. He says, the impression you get is this. Taking all the old records he can. I say he's quite an old man, but very, very alert. He'd studied comparative religion all his life. And he says, the impression is that of people plunked right down from another planet with all this stuff completely developed when they brought it here. And then everything's been unraveling ever since. The language is in its most highly developed form, and all the other languages have been derived from it since. The knowledge of everything, this is so. And the religious ideas are more complex. There's a... Hockett has been doing some work on that recently, too. They've been pointing out, since the war, this is what they've been discovering. There is so little variety whenever we look back there. There are not thousands of languages. There are not thousands of religious ideas. There are not thousands of rituals. There's just one, but the one is quite elaborate. It's not the sort of thing anyone would make up offhand. And everybody seemed to have it. And the farther back you go, the more alike people become in their beliefs and their knowledge, and yet the more elaborate the structure becomes. Not the simpler, but the more elaborate it becomes. The more sophisticated it becomes. It's the same thing with language till you get back. An extremely elaborate structure. Very. So this is a very puzzling thing. Now, Henry Eyring is editing a series of articles on subjects relating to science and religion. He asked me to contribute an article on Archaeology and Our Religion is the title of it. And we're going to take this up, this thing, because this certainly is the trend in archaeology today, that everything is converging on this interplanetary culture, so to speak. This is the impression you get. You start out with these very smart people that had a complete control of everything, and everything has been coasting and running down and dispersing from that point ever since. Nothing is added. As we noted last night, the Oriental imagination. There's no Oriental imagination. You go back in this literature, nobody ever invents anything. There are a few variations on the theme added from local experiences, not from local invention, but from local experience, from descriptions from the local scene, but that's it. They tell the same stories wherever you go, and the same things are repeated. You can get all this stuff from the Thousand and One Nights. It's all there. Nobody has any original ideas at all. It's the funniest thing you can imagine. The only people who get any original ideas, occasionally like the Greeks, are people that attribute it strictly to revelation. The Greeks themselves, I once made an analysis when I was in Berkeley of all the original Greeks, and without a single exception, every one of them said, it's not my idea, I got it by revelation. It came to me just like that. Now, there's a book on that, a very good one, just recently by the dean of classical scholars in Germany, Walter Otto, called Die Musen, On the Muses. The idea that the Greeks believed that any ideas they really got were inspired, that they couldn't, actually, it was not in man to produce an idea of himself. And it seems to be the case. If we have anything given to us at all, it's going to come to us. It's going to be given. We don't make things up. We can sit down. Once a civilization has reached a point of no return or decay, we become cynical. We can hold boards and committees. We can... Well, look, in the 1950s, the first period in modern science when not a single major discovery was made in technology. Now, in the 60s, we got the laser to redeem us. But it's funny. There are 250,000 registered scientists in the United States. Well, do we make 250,000 discoveries a day? I've seen the book circulating a good deal recently, The Organization Man. You notice in there the reports he gives, the editors of Fortune and so forth, how we go decades without a single new idea, with thousands of highly paid technicians and scientists working their heads off. But you never get ideas that way, unless they're given to you. It's a surprising thing. Go on and on. There, I just read this book of C.P. Snow's, his autobiographical work called The Search. He was a scientist, quite a good physicist, searching. And he tells there, when he decided to leave science, he gave it up. When the dean of British physicists, the greatest physical scientist in England at Cambridge, who was the leader in the world in that time, certainly Cambridge was, said, there's no more left to discover from now on. We'll just be filling in a few gaps and that's all. He says, we're not going anywhere. He couldn't see any possibility of discovery. Of course, that's why creativity or creation is a miracle, because it's possible a man comes along and creates something after everything has already been created. That's why it does seem like a miracle. Everybody's tried everything. Everybody's got their degrees, and they've been on their committees, and they've got their titles, and they're working like mad, and nobody has an idea we're shooting at. And then some cluck comes along and comes out with something, and that is the miracle. But it's been done time and again. You say there's nothing left to discover. That has been said hundreds and thousands of times. My old professor, Linforth, and he's over 90 years old and still going strong, my old Greek professor, I took Greek prose, style, composition, drama, and various things from him. He said quite categorically in his younger years, he says, there is nothing to be done in the field of ancient history. Everything has been found. He insisted on it. Well, there was nothing to be done by him in the field, that's certain. He never had an idea in his life and never will. But we have definitely misjudged the ancients. We've got it totally. Our picture of the early world is completely out of focus. Many people are beginning to realize that. His Gardner, I quoted tonight, in his last work, just before he died, and he lived over 90. Some of these characters really hang on, don't they? He just died a few weeks ago in England. He was the grand old man of the Egyptologists. And in this work, he says the same thing. He says, we don't know a darn thing about Egypt. We're missing the boat. There's something there we just don't know. And that something happens to be everything. If we only knew that. So there's a very important ingredient that's missing here, and somebody here might stumble on it someday, but that's the sort of thing we're working on. It's the only thing that keeps universities going. If we discovered everything already, well, of course, basketball teams, things like that.